Only four chapters remain in our studies in the two letters of Paul to the Corinthians, and those four chapters constitute one complete unit, 2 Corinthians chapters 10 to 13. It's unfortunate that we have to break them into two, but there's no way of getting around it. We simply can't get through those four chapters effectively in the one study. So I've divided them, chapters 10 and 11, Paul talks about authority, and then chapters 12 and 13, Paul talks about self-examination. But really it's the one story, the one theme that runs right through these four chapters. And it's quite different from what has gone previously. In fact, it's so different that some people have suggested that these four chapters in fact constitute the severe letter that has been referred to earlier. Now, I don't think that is necessarily so, and I think it's best to look upon them as part of the letter which Paul wrote to the Corinthians when he was in Macedonia. In other words, the whole 13 chapters of this letter hang together as one complete unit, the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians as we have it in our Bible. However, it's quite clear that these four chapters are in a different tone from the previous nine chapters. And we gather from that either there was a break in Paul's writing. Perhaps he had written the first nine chapters and then the next day or 2 days later he got some more news and found that things in Corinth were not quite as under control as he had hoped. Or maybe he had heard from Titus anyway that in spite of the general change in atmosphere in Corinth, there was still the possibility that the false prophets or the false apostles would come back and stir up a hornet's nest again. Well, I won't speak any further on that right now. I think you'll grab the idea as we move along. These four chapters are really quite fiery. In fact, I don't know that I've ever heard anybody preach a sermon on these four chapters. I've heard one or two favourite verses here and there, but generally speaking, they're not preached on. And I suppose as you look at them, it's fairly easy to guess why. Because I think a lot of people are a little bit embarrassed when they find how sharp some of Paul's language is. He's very sarcastic in some of the things he says here. Some people think perhaps Christians shouldn't be like that, and so they steer off this section. But there's no doubt that Paul has very good grounds for speaking the way he does. Sometimes there are only certain ways of bringing people to their senses. And Paul here sees that the people aren't going to respond very favourably to ordinary speech, so he attacks them with some very ironical words. Now, he's talking very much about his apostolic status, because some of the Corinthians were still troubled by these travelling preachers. And these travelling preachers Paul refers to as super apostles, in inverted commas. They were in fact false apostles, but Paul refers to them as the extra special super duper apostles because that's what they considered themselves, and some of the Corinthians also seem to have looked upon these travelling apostles as being a cut above Paul. You find in the Good News Bible that when it refers to these apostles, it puts the word apostles in inverted commas. Some of them had apparently questioned Paul's authority, and they had won over quite a number of the Corinthians to their side. They had accused Paul of being weak, of being second rate. They said he's only an ordinary worldly man, he's just a tent maker. He's not really an apostle at all because he doesn't work full time in the work. I mean, we do, they say. We go around preaching and we're professional preachers and we are fully accredited teachers of the Christian truth. But Paul is really only a labourer. He's a layman, he's ill-trained, he's not supported by the gifts from the Christians in the churches, and anyway he's a fairly poor teacher, he doesn't have the same polish that we have. And so they had all these statements that they were making, and of course they were undermining Paul's ministry. Not only that, but they were undermining his apostolic status, saying that he wasn't really in the same class as some of these other apostolic preachers. And by apostolic, I'm not meaning the 12, of course. There was a wider group of apostles than the 12, and these people claimed that they belonged to this special group of people who had extra status in the church. Well, Paul says they're not really true apostles at all, these fellows. They're false apostles. They consider themselves to be super apostles, and Paul talks of them in that language, but you find that he doesn't have any respect for them at all. Now, some of the Corinthians had been saying that Paul was cowardly. But he appeared tough at a distance. When he wrote his letters from a distance, he was tough. But when he was there among them, he really was very, very ordinary indeed. Now that's the accusation that they made, and that's the point that Paul starts on in chapter 10, verse 1. I, Paul, myself entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. And then he has an aside. I, Paul, who am humble when face to face with you, but bold to you when I'm away. And that, of course, is what the people were saying. So there's a little bit of a barb in what he's saying there. I, who am cowardly, as my opponents would say, they'd say I'm cowardly when I'm face to face with you, but I'm really tough stuff when I'm a long way away. Well, he says, I beg you, verse 2, when I am present, I don't want to have to show boldness with such confidence as I count on showing against some who suspect us of acting in worldly fashion. These false apostles had mistaken Paul's tolerance for weakness. And of course, that's a very common failing. People have mistaken God's tolerance for weakness. They mistook the forbearance of God for weakness. They thought that when God didn't come down in heavy-handed judgment upon them because of their sin, that therefore he approved of it. They didn't realize that the forbearance of God was intended to lead them to repentance. So it is with Paul. Paul hasn't come down with a heavy-handed judgment. He has withheld time and time again. He has the authority to execute judgment upon the church in Corinth. He has apostolic authority given him by Christ to carry out whatever the judgment happens to be. He has an authority which was exceptional. But Paul says, I have not used that authority. I have refrained from using it because I don't want to force people to do things through a heavy-handed judgment upon them. I would rather reason with them, that they would see their error and that they would submit out of an inner conviction, not because they're forced to. Now that is the theme right through these four chapters. The correct use of authority. And I believe elders in churches, leaders in churches, Bible teachers, people who have authority in the ministry which Christ has entrusted to them, must take a lesson from Paul. Sometimes it may be necessary to speak very plainly, as Paul does in these chapters. But they should not use their authority too eagerly. It's far better to work in a way which is going to shepherd people along so that they can see for themselves what the issues are. They can get an inner conviction about it. They can be brought to see a point of view through their own spiritual response. That is far better than having to impose a judgment upon them. That is better than having to come down with a heavy hand and force them. People who pull their rank on others all the time generally are betraying a less than Christian attitude. Oh yes, the authority may be there. God has put authority within certain leaders in the church, but they must be hesitant at using that authority heavy-handedly. Now that's exactly what Paul's on about here. He says, I have this authority, I have refrained from using it, because I would much rather be patient with you so that you yourselves can get the conviction concerning what you should do. Now as a result, some people have suspected us of being weak. Okay, says Paul, if they suspect us of being weak, well, I suppose we just have to wear it. But, he says, I am being tolerant and I am not going to use my authority in a worldly fashion. And that's what he means in verses 3 and 4. Now these two verses have been used out of their context, and I'm not saying they've been used wrongly, where Paul says, although we live in the world, we are not carrying on a worldly war, for the weapons of our warfare are not worldly, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. Now those have been used, of course, in relation to the Christians' conflict in the world. And I suppose that's a reasonable application. But in their original context, they're speaking of Paul's use of his authority. And Paul says, I'm not going to use my authority like a worldly person, like a politician, or a boss in some business, or a schoolmaster. That's not a broadside at politicians or businessmen or schoolmasters, because in certain situations you have to use authority decisively. But Paul says, in the church, I don't want to use my authority decisively. I don't want to be a schoolmaster to people. In a school you can be like that, he says, but not in the church. I don't want to be like a boss in a business. I don't want to be like a politician. I don't want to be like a policeman. Policemen and law enforcers, they have their place in society. But he says, in the church, I don't want to use authority like that. I don't want to act like a worldly person. I don't want to use my authority to force people. He says, I want Christians to submit out of a sense of submission to Christ and submission to each other. And he says, if they do that, then that will be a far greater power than any political power such as is exercised in the world of men. Now that's what he means. He says, so we live in the world, but he says we're not carrying on a worldly warfare. This ministry which is entrusted to us in the context of the church is something that functions through divine power. And in verse 5 he says, we destroy arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God, and we take every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. In other words, he says, this is a power, this spiritual power I'm speaking of here, says Paul, is a power which will destroy pride, which will control the inner attitudes of people. People in this world who have authority, as I've said, in political or law enforcement or in business or in education, whatever it is, people have that authority to control people who are under them and to bring about the objectives that they're aiming for. But he says, in the church, we have a power which is greater than that. Now, people can use their political or governmental authority to control, but that authority will not destroy pride within the heart of a person, and it will not change the inner attitudes of people. But, says Paul, the way I'm exercising authority in the church, by refraining from this heavy-handed use of it, he says, in this way, we are promoting a nobler attitude towards authority, because the weapons of our warfare are not going to be worldly, but he says they're going to be spiritual. And if people respond in this way through submission to Christ and to each other, then, he says, we'll achieve what the ordinary exercise of authority could never achieve. We will achieve, he says, destruction of pride. We will achieve mental discipline, if I can use that word, where even our thoughts and our attitudes, even those inner constraints, are brought into obedience to Christ. And he says that is a result which can never be achieved through the sheer exercise of power in its own right. However, he says, once you Corinthians have submitted, if those false apostles still refuse to submit, then as a last resort I will have to use that power which is mine by divine authority. And so I am ready, in verse 6 he says, to punish every disobedience once your obedience is complete. And then in the following verses he draws their attention to what they have witnessed. Verse 7. The false apostles had claimed Christ's authority. Well, says Paul, what's special about that? So have we. The very fact that they've claimed Christ's authority is no reason for you to reject us. He says, we also have Christ's authority. If anyone is confident that he is Christ's, let him remind himself that as he is Christ, so are we. And even if I boast a little too much of our authority, and he has boasted perhaps once or twice as he's referred to the fact that the church in Corinth was established through him, and that the Corinthians have ample evidence before their own eyes of the apostolic status of Paul. He's mentioned that two or three times earlier in the letter. He says, even if I have boasted a little too much of our authority, which the Lord gave, incidentally, for building you up and not for destroying you, he just gets his tuppence worth as he's on the subject there, because he says these false apostles have been destroying and creating confusion and conflict in the church, whereas he said, I used my authority to build up the church. Even if I do boast of this authority, he says, I shall not be put to shame. I would not seem to be frightening you with letters, verse 9. Now that's what the opponents had said. These false apostles, these chaps that were jealous of Paul, they said, oh yes, he writes these tough letters from a distance. Perhaps that's a reference to the severe letter that we talked about in the opening few chapters. Oh yes, they say he's really big cheese with a pen in his hand 400 miles away, but he's not nearly so clever when he's face to face. That's what they say in verse 10. His letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech is of no account. He's as weak as water, they say. Well, says Paul, verse 11, let such people understand that what we say by letter when absent, we do when present. You'll find out that I carry out the things I say. Not that we venture to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves. Don't think, says Paul, that I've entered the competition against these chaps, that I'm entering the status stakes to see whether I'm better than they are. He said, I'm not that stupid. I'm not going to enter this race that they've got going there to see who's the cleverest and who's the best and who's the greatest. I'm not going to compare myself with them. In fact, he says in verse 12 that when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they're without understanding. They're block-headed, he said. It's a boneless, brainless thing to do, to go comparing yourselves with each other. And that's a very bold statement that Paul makes, and I think we ought to take a lot more notice of it than we do. I remember reading something from Derek Kidner once. He has a delightful way of putting things. He said, the most misleading way to feel wise is to feel superior. The most misleading way to feel wise is to feel superior. And here people are misleading themselves. They're deceiving themselves because they're comparing themselves with each other, and of course, naturally, they're considering themselves better. That's what these false apostles were doing. And Paul says, what a stupid thing to do. If we compare ourselves with one another, inevitably we're going to rank ourselves better. We're very biased towards ourselves to start with. In fact, the very final verse of the chapter, if I can just pass over a few in the meantime, he said, it is not the man who commends himself that is accepted, but the man whom the Lord commends. So let us bear that in mind. Now, just before we get to that final verse, there are a few other verses in between, verses 13 to 17, where Paul speaks of issues that I had touched upon earlier. And those issues concerned his desire to consolidate the work in Corinth before moving further west. Now, these false teachers, these false apostles, in coming to Corinth the way they had, were really trespassing on Paul's ground. Paul had done the work in Corinth, and now these had come in and cashed in on what he had done. Now, we know from earlier references in the first letter that he had nothing against somebody coming in to really build on that work, as Apollos had done, for example. In fact, he encouraged Apollos to go. But these other people were the types that you and I are familiar with. They'll come in on somebody else's work, and then they'll take it over. They're egocentric people, they're self-seekers, and they're out to push their own claims. They had trespassed on Paul's ground. They had not come in with noble motives or to help what Paul had done, but simply to grab some of the fame for themselves. So Paul reminds the Corinthians in verse 14, he says, we are not overextending ourselves as though we did not reach to you. In other words, in writing like this and seeking to direct you, don't think that I'm stepping out of line or I'm doing something that I'm not entitled to. He says, you know that we were the first to come to you with the gospel of Christ. So in writing to you and in seeking to direct the church, I'm not overreaching myself. I'm not stepping off into somebody else's territory. I myself planted the church there. I look upon you as my children in the Lord, and so I am speaking in this way for your good. I have this right because, he says, I planted the church there. I am like a father to the church, so to speak. These people have become Christians through the work of Paul. So in verse 15, we do not boast beyond our limit, as these false apostles had done. He says, I do not boast in another man's labours. There's another little barb for these false apostles, because that's precisely what they were doing. They were cashing in on what Paul had done. But our hope is that as your faith increases and the church gets back to some normality and stability, our field among you may be greatly enlarged so that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you. And here it is again, without boasting of work already done in another's field. I'm not going to stoop to what these low characters are on about. They boast of work done in another's field. They come and try to selfishly grab the benefits of the work that I have done. Well, he says, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to break out into areas where nobody has reached and take the gospel there. Now, he goes on in chapter 11 to point out that he's not inferior to others, and this is where he becomes very ironical and very cutting in some of the things he says. He says, I wish you'd bear with me in a little foolishness. Now, he's going to boast here, and of course he knows that all boasting is foolish. But sometimes it's necessary to speak the way Paul is speaking here, because people are so impervious to other forms of approach. Sometimes it's better not to try to defend ourselves, and Paul, on many, many occasions, knew what it was to keep his mouth quiet and not even to try to defend himself. But then there are other occasions when it would be foolish to keep quiet. It may be necessary to speak up, lest these other people completely dominate the scene with the false statements they were putting across. And so Paul feels he must counter the propaganda of these false teachers. And therefore he says, I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. I'm going to boast. Now, he said, I know this is a bit stupid, but at least it might stop you believing the spiel that these false teachers are putting across. So please bear with me, he says in verse 1, because I feel a divine jealousy for you, for I betrothed you to Christ to present you as a pure bride to her one husband. I feel, he says, like a father feels for his daughter. He's jealous for his daughter's purity, in a sense, and he wants to see that daughter grow up and then be presented to her husband in due course. Paul says, I feel that sort of concern, that sort of love, that sort of jealousy for you, as a father feels for his daughter. Because, he said, I was the one who led you to Christ, and I want to see you maintain that loyalty to Christ and not be led astray by these worthless characters that come along and the various attractions before you. I'm afraid, in verse 3, that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ, led astray through these characters with their persuasive speech. He says, if someone comes and preaches another Jesus than the one we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or if you accept a different gospel from the one you accept, you submit to it readily enough. And there he's criticizing them. He said, it's a disgrace that you should so readily submit to these people who bring different teaching. He said, you've turned away from the teaching I gave you. Now, he says, I don't think in verse 5 that I'm in the least inferior to these superlative apostles, these extra special apostles. He said, I'm not inferior to them. Again, the Good News Bible puts the word apostles there in quotes, which I think really gets the idea across. When Paul says, I think in the King James Version, it says that he's not inferior to the chiefest of the apostles, I don't think we should think of that in terms of Matthew and Peter and John and those people. He's not speaking of those at all. That's not what he's talking about when he's talking about the chief apostles. He's talking in an ironical sense, in a sarcastic sense, of these people who thought they were chief apostles. They thought they were great stuff. They were the best. They were the super apostles. And time and again through this section, Paul is referring to these false apostles who consider themselves a cut above Paul. Well, Paul says, I don't consider them a cut above me. I don't think I'm in the least inferior to them. Even if I am unskilled in speaking, I'm not in knowledge. In every way we have made this plain to you in all things. And so Paul didn't have the appearance that some of these fellows had. Perhaps Paul was not ranked among the 10 best dressed men of the country. Perhaps Paul was not really in line to become a newsreader on the ABC or something like that. He said, I'm not one of these characters that could get carried away like these false apostles. I might be unskilled in speech. I may not have the smooth presentation that these fellows have. It looks like all this talk about image isn't a recent thing after all. People voting for politicians because they comb their hair a certain way or they can smile nicely on TV and all that nonsense that we see today. So much importance is placed on image. And I'm afraid in the church it's the same. When a person comes along, he's got a bit of a pleasant personality, he can speak well, he has a good presentation, got a nice suit, nice appearance, and he looks just the part, and he knows how to get the audience on side, and people get sucked in by it. Those are not the things we should be judging on at all. It's not this type of presentation, it's not the appearance, it's not the skill in speech, the suave style, or the appealing personality. That's not the thing that's important. What is the man saying? What's the content of what he's saying? That's the important thing. And Paul says, I might be a bit unskilled in speaking, but he says, I'm not in knowledge, and that's the important thing. He said, it's what a person knows, not the glamorous presentation he has. And in every way we have made this plain to you. So he says, even if I may be not as good as they are at putting over a good sermon, at least the teaching I give you is plain and simple and, above all, true. And that must always be our main consideration. Please, can we remind ourselves of this? And not get too easily impressed by people that have that TV type appeal but have nothing of substance to support it. Now, Paul had lived among them very much as a labourer. In verse 7, he talks about abasing himself. That is, he worked at ordinary manual work, whereas all these other chaps, of course, they went to all the meetings and they prayed and they read the Bible and they gave sermons and they did the things that religious people are supposed to do. And of course, they won some status in the eyes of the church. And while they were doing all that, Paul had been labouring away to get some money to support himself. And so they looked upon Paul as being a little bit second rate. He wasn't really a professional preacher in the true mould that they had come to expect. Paul says, did I commit a sin in abasing myself so that you might be exalted? He says, I preached the gospel without cost to you. And the reason that I worked with my hands was to present the gospel without cost to you. I didn't want to take any money from you. I didn't want to create any stumbling block for you. And I was prepared to work my fingers to the bone, work long hours to get my income in some other way so that you wouldn't be burdened. In fact, in verse 8 he says, I robbed other churches by accepting support from them in order to serve you. The churches from Macedonia, for example, time and again sent money to Paul. The Corinthian church didn't give money to Paul because Paul preferred not to take it from them lest they should misunderstand. But he readily accepted gifts that were sent to him from other churches. And he says, I robbed those churches, not in the literal sense of the word that he went and plundered them. He took money from those other churches in order to relieve the Corinthians of the burden. So he says, I accepted this support from other churches in order to serve you. And verse 9, when I was with you and I was in want, and there were those times when he felt the pinch, he says, I didn't burden any of you, for my needs were supplied by the brethren who came from Macedonia. And as we've seen earlier, Macedonia was a poor area, whereas Corinth was a fairly wealthy area. So I refrained, and I will continue to refrain from burdening any of you in any way. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boast of mine shall not be silenced in the regions of Achaia, where Corinth was situated. I will continue, he says. I will continue to support myself. I will continue to refuse support from Corinth so that nobody can have any cause for thinking that I have come there for my own benefit or to achieve something that's going to help me in any way whatever. I'm not going to profit, he says, out of the work I'm doing there in Corinth. Now, why am I doing this, verse 11? Because I don't love you? God knows that I do. I'm doing it because I do love you. And he said, it hurts me in the very innermost part of my being to think that you've misinterpreted my motives. And you've looked upon it as if I've insulted you. And they had taken it as an insult. They thought it was a slight that Paul had not accepted support. And Paul says, do you think that I've done this because I don't love you? God knows. He says, I do love you. And I've done this for you because it was out of my best motives and out of deep consideration for your own well-being. Verse 12, what I do, I will continue to do, in order to undermine the claim of those who would like to claim that in their boasted mission they work on the same terms as we do. I'm going to keep it this way, he says, so that you can see the difference between the true apostle and the false apostles. The false apostles will keep on taking the money from you, but he says, I am going to keep on refusing to take it so that you can see the difference between those who are out simply for themselves and those who are concerned really for the work of God. Because these false apostles in verse 13 are deceitful workmen, and they disguise themselves as apostles of Christ. And it's no wonder, he says, because even Satan can disguise himself as an angel of light. So it's not strange if even these false apostles can disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. And then from verse 16 to the end of the chapter, we have this very, very spicy section where Paul recounts his experiences as an apostle. He says, I repeat, must smile as you read some of these verses. There's no doubt that Paul is, his blood pressure has gone up a little bit as he's been writing this chapter, and now he really brings it to something of a climax. He says, I repeat, verse 16, let no one think me foolish, but even if you do, well, accept me as a fool. Okay, you think I'm a fool, all right, well, that's all right. He says, accept me as a fool, so that I too may boast a little. I mean, after all, you accept the boasting of these other chaps, so he says, if they boast, well, maybe I can have a boast as well. Perhaps it will bring you to your senses. Straight, plain talking doesn't seem to have any effect on you. Maybe, he says, if I colour up a little bit with a few nice barbs and a bit of irony and sarcasm and a few questions, perhaps, he says, that will bring you to your senses. What I am saying, in verse 17, he says, what I am saying, I say not with the Lord's authority, but as a fool. So he says, I'm not really preaching like a good apostolic preacher now. He says, I'm talking like a clown in this boastful confidence. Since many boast of worldly things, I too will boast. You're used to it, he says. These false apostles come across and they've got a string of worldly boasts, he said, that would make anybody else look very inferior. Well, he says, if they can boast, I'm going to have a shot too. Let's see how good I can be. After all, verse 19, he says, you bear fools gladly. So, he says, I'm sure you'll be able to put up with me. In fact, he says in verse 20, you bear it if a man makes a slave of you. And that's what the false apostles had done. They had made slaves of them. They had got them into bondage. They had made a prey of them. They had taken advantage of you, he says. They had taken the Corinthians' money. They had stuffed their pockets full of the best stuff. He says, they put on airs, and they've struck you in the face. Verse 20. He says, you suffer it when these people come and treat you like this. He says, what's wrong with you folks that you can put up with the tantrums and the actions of these characters? To my shame, I say, we were too weak for that. Verse 21. Oh, says Paul, I can't compare with those fellows. Oh, he says, they're far too tough for me. And of course, the Corinthians had said that Paul was weak in comparison. Of Paul says, yes, I'm weak, all right. He says, I'm too weak for that. He says, I'm not going to make a prey of you or take advantage of you. And so as he says these things, you can just imagine the Corinthian church there, hopefully starting to realize that they've been on the wrong track. And some sharp words like this from Paul is probably just what they needed. So he goes on now to boast. He says, whatever anyone dares to boast of, and now I'm speaking as a fool. Remember, he says, I'm not the good straight preacher up front doing all the right things. He says, but I'm speaking as a fool, but then you like fools, so just tolerate me for a little while, and you'll see that I'm not really a second rate at all, and certainly I'm not inferior to these other clowns that you're tolerating. So whatever anyone dares to boast of, I also dare to boast of that. Here I go, he says. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I'm a better one, he says. Now, I'm talking like a madman, but he says, I'm a better servant of Christ than they are. And now he gives the reasons why. He says, far greater labors, far more imprisonments, countless beatings, often near death. 5 times I've received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. 3 times I've been beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I've been shipwrecked. A night and a day I've been adrift in the sea. I've been on frequent journeys. I've been in danger from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my own people, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers at sea, dangers from false brethren. I've been in toil and hardship. I've been through many a sleepless night. I've been in hunger. I've been in thirst. I've been without food. I've been in cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there's the daily pressure upon me of my anxiety for all the churches. And that is a greater pressure than all these other things, he says. Oh, well, that was a mouthful. Paul at least has spelt it out for them, hasn't he? Who is weak and I'm not weak? Who is made to fall and I'm not indignant? He says, I feel people's troubles as if they're my own. And he says, I will suffer along with them. Paul realizes that the work of a servant of God is not all plain sailing. And in spite of all his physical difficulties, surely the thing which weighs upon a person most is what Paul talks about in verses 28 and 29. The care of the churches, the interpersonal relationships, the problems that people have, those are far more draining on a person than some of the physical afflictions which he has outlined in the previous verses. Well, he's had quite a boast, but now the important point is this. When he looks back on the things that he's boasted of, they are the sorts of things that the ordinary person is normally ashamed of. Most of us would be ashamed if we'd been locked up. We'd be ashamed of all the different beatings and disgraces that had overtaken us. And there's no doubt that there were many shameful things that had happened to these apostles as they'd gone around. They'd been beaten, they'd been driven out of cities. How would we like it if we were driven out of the town? I don't think many of us would go looking for that sort of publicity. To be shamed in the public marketplace, to have people spit at you and call you names and things of that nature, to be up before the courts, to have your name in the newspapers as one who has been in trouble with the law, all the things that we'd be ashamed of. As Paul looks back, the things that he's now boasting about are personal humiliations. And yet he says, that's fair enough, because if I must boast, then I will boast of the things that show my weakness. Because spiritual power does not consist in the greatness which this world calls greatness. He's really referring here to the sorts of things he referred to in our opening section, where he said, though we live in the world, we're not carrying on a worldly war. For the weapons of our warfare are not worldly, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. And so we destroy arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive to obey Christ. Now that's the sort of thing he's talking about. Not the things that the worldly person would boast about. It's not the authority that the worldly person might exercise. The things Paul is boasting about here are not the sorts of things that are going to be normally the sorts of things people will boast about. Why? Because he says he wants the glory and the strength and the honour to be given to Jesus Christ. The authority which he exercises is an authority to change the lives of men, and it's an authority that derives from God. It's an authority which is exercised in the lives of people as people respond to the appeal of the gospel and submit to Jesus Christ and submit to each other. The things that we boast of, if any man boasts, let him boast in the Lord. And although Paul has boasted of these various troubles that he's had, all the things he has boasted of are personal humiliations. And the reason is going to be, again, we've got to stop halfway through, I'm afraid. We've finished chapter 11 now, but he's going to go on in chapter 12 to say that one of the reasons why he boasts in these things is because when he is weak, then he is strong. And it's out of these weaknesses and humiliations that he proves the power of God and the power of Christ. And that, ultimately, is the real thing in which a person glories. Now that's a good point to finish on, because I think it's a challenge for us. And it's also a good point for us to pick up the story when we continue in our final study on chapters 12 and 13, where Paul continues in the same vein as these previous two chapters, but he brings it to a glorious climax as he challenges the Christians not only to hear the rebukes which he is levelling at them, but also to examine themselves to see where indeed they stand before God.